Right, guys, today I'm joined by casting director Lucy Lennox, all the way from Barcelona. Lucy, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Great, thank you for having me here.
My pleasure.
I'm here. I mean, I think I'm like everybody, waiting to see what's going to happen, very concerned about the state of the industry, very concerned about what's happening in the United States. And, you know, so much more, I suppose it's almost ironic to do this. I'm much more in a listening mode than a talking mode today, but I will answer your questions.
Welcome to the actor's sort of perpetual training of listen, listen, listen. But you're right, it's perspective, I think, has been a heavy dose of it in the last few months and few days. And I think a lot of people I've been talking to before what's been happening in the States have come out of it saying, look, like, we have to learn and shift into something new when we get out of whatever this lockdown is. What that looks like, who knows, right? We have to be cultivating and crafting that. And I guess from your world and what you do in the casting perspective, we were just saying before we hit record there that you're kind of getting back into it, but we don't know what that is yet, right?
And it's just interesting. It's like the projects, some of the projects that I was working on before are kicking off now, and some of them will be, and I was asking, like, the producers, are you going to rewrite the scripts to make reference, like, when they're contemporary projects? Are you going to have people, you know, wearing masks? Are you going to talk about it? And it's, and people don't know yet. I mean, there's going to be a lot of different kind of issues that people need to resolve, you know, just apart from the, you know, the basic issue of how are we going to shoot. You know, we did a trial run last week where we shot an ad here to show that we could to try out the protocols. That's interesting. So that's one side. And then what are the stories that we're going to tell? Like, how big an effect is this going to have? Because I think, I feel very much like I'm seeing people, you know, my closest friends, I'm seeing them for the first time this, in the last week, because we haven't met. There are people I would have seen every day, or at least every couple of days for, you know, most of my adult life. And now we haven't seen each other for 2 months, nearly 3 months. And it's just assessing where we are, you know, and how people are feeling, and, you know, are people feeling, I mean, I think people are feeling a little bit bruised and sensitive. It's a little bit like coming out into bright sunshine, you know, and it's complicated.
Yeah, the one thing I think that wasn't spoken about much, slowly has been creeping into the dialogue, is that idea of the longer-term mental health kind of issues for people, how they've been impacted. So many different stories. I know a lot of people that have isolated by themselves, and they've spent 10, 12 weeks alone without human contact. And there's nothing healthy about that. And how do you then reacclimatize?
I think that's going to be a big issue. And it's very, I mean, I think mental health wasn't taken into account, particularly in Spain. I don't really know. I know in the UK people were allowed out to work, but in Spain we had a very extreme lockdown. And it was very complicated. For people with mental health issues, and particularly, I mean, I know quite a lot of people with mental health issues, as everybody does, because, I mean, we all have mental
health. We all have them. We just, the label scares people, right? But,
and, you know, some of them, I know one, you know, actress, and she's been in hospital. She didn't, you know, she got very sick very early on. And I was, you know, very aware that it was because she wasn't able to do the things that help her to keep healthy, you know, which is basic health contact. And I'm seeing, you know, I think it's very important. And then it's interesting because there's some people with mental health issues who this has suited them. It's been better for them, because there's people who have, you know, extreme anxiety where about in social context, and they've been able to stay at home, and they've actually had quite a nice 10 weeks, and it's going to be difficult for them to adjust, because in some ways the pressure's been off. You haven't had to be, you haven't had to go out. And I know a few people, you know, with extreme mental health issues related more to anxiety and social agoraphobia, and they've felt more comfortable. So it's an interesting assessment of, like, you know, if going out is very stressful. I know for me, I'm an extrovert, so I like going out. I like seeing people. I like running a very busy casting studio. And I found it extremely difficult mentally for the first couple of weeks, where it was very unsure what was happening. I didn't spend it on my own, because, and I live on my own normally, but I okay with me, and I'm very grateful and glad that that happened, because I don't think it would have been at all good for my mental health, and I'm aware of the effect of it, especially in extreme, you know. And that's one of the reasons why I set up Get Inspired, was it was a very nice way for me, and it's why I suggested it to Kristen Dania, who I set it up with. It was a nice way to be able to check in with actors who are on their own, you know, because I run a studio, I'm a casting director, but we also have classes here, so I felt a very strong duty of care for the people that would normally pop in, you know, and my studio is a very open door kind of place, so people pop up in, they tell me their problems, they talk, you know, not constantly, it's not a, you know,
revolving door.
It's not a revolving door, but it is somewhere that people know is a safe place to come and, you know, generally come and ask questions. And I felt that that wasn't going to happen, but I didn't really feel like spending individual time. I felt like it's just, I needed to create a space that people could come to, which is what I have physically normally. And we were able to recreate that online during this lockdown period. So I was very happy about that.
And that's been one of the kind of really amazing things, I think, that there's been so many people like yourself who've found a way to keep the connection going in all kinds of industries, not just, you know, film and acting and the casting world, but you know, talking about that, because that is our industry,
yeah.
The casting world and the casting directors that have taken their time to maintain those connections and reach out to people and to use the free time they have, I suppose, to meet new people has been amazing. And it's kind of unprecedented as well. It's been great, I think, for actors. I think it's probably been great as well for casting, just to, you know, many people I've talked to have said it's helped keep them sane in some ways, because they've had connection as much as this is connection, I suppose. How have you been teaching classes online then as well during this period, or was it just a check-in kind of thing?
No, I've been teaching just the Manuel Puro class, which is how I met you.
Yes.
Because I was already booked to do that, and I was delighted that that was going to happen during that. And then, because it was, I asked my mother, you know, if it's overbooked, I'll do another one. So I've done a couple of those during this time because they were full. And I was like, okay, well, I have more time than I've ever had before. And I also teach online at the university, the film school here in Barcelona, which is the SCAC, but I teach directors. I don't teach actors. So I'm teaching about the process of casting, which is kind of, that's a course, it's part of a master's program. Which is, I do 12 hours of that, which is their, how long they study casting for in that program.
That's really interesting. I don't know if they teach cast, do they teach casting in many film schools? I don't think I've heard of that being an offering in a lot of them.
It's a very bizarre thing. I think it's something, I'm a strong advocate for it to be taught. I mean, there's a very good book that directors should read, which is called Casting Revealed by Hester Shell, I think her name is. I was Hester Shell. It's on my bibliography for my students. I think casting, I mean, you know, people like Hitchcock said, you know, casting is 75% of the success of a film. And, you know, we're always talked about script. Script is very important. You can't make a good film, a bad film with a bad script. You can't make a good film with a bad script, is what they say. But I really think that you cannot make a good film with a bad cast either. And I don't think people understand. I mean, part of what I teach in casting, when I teach the students, I mean, we have a, you know, this is my like curriculum for it, but it's like not just what the casting process is and, you know, what a casting director does, which they don't understand, but, you know, what constitutes good and what constitutes bad casting. Mm-hmm. And then I try to get them to work on their self-confidence so that they will be able to fight for the actors that they want to be part of their universe. I think it's one of the things that actors never seem to really know about directors is that, you know, actors are always, you're always very, very nervous when you go to auditions, but really you have much less to lose than the casting director, and the casting director has much less to lose than the director. Like directors, and I was talking to these guys that they're about to make short films, and I say, remember that every actor you have then becomes part of your universe as a filmmaker. And, you know, even the most famous and the most prolific filmmakers in the world don't make hundreds of films. They might make 10. You know, if you think about your famous director, your favorite directors, how many films will they make? Not that many. Mm. So it's very important that they consider the casting process. And then we talk a lot about it was very interesting yesterday in the classes because I asked them, I said, my question, you know, it's one of the exercises. Tell me your six favorite actors and why. How do you respond to them? And these students are from all over the world. And then mainly the names that they came up with were Hollywood stars. And I was like, you know, I didn't ask you your six favorite Hollywood stars. I would have been much happier to have heard about, you know, the Turkish actors or the Georgian actors, the people that you're likely to work with in your career, the people who are exciting. But if you think that you have to go for the safe option because everybody else will have heard of it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's about teaching people to think creatively so that they do better casting, which is kind of what casting directors do. So I was trying to explain to them what I do because I know that everybody can't have Scarlett Johansson in their film. So I have to learn how to sell Ashley as the next hot actor to the industry. And it's an important thing that I think directors and young filmmakers need to learn as well. And then we talked a lot about, you know, the ethics of casting. You know, I'm very, you know, we can go back to the, you know, I'm very pro diversity in casting, but I'm pro because that's what is part of my personal beliefs. So I would apply that to whatever industry I've worked in. I've worked in other industries, not in the film industry, but because I think that's for the greater good. It's not just about because it's right. I mean, there's some things in the world that are just right. And there's some things that it's just like, it just, for me, it's common sense, you know, equality is common sense. Treating everybody like you would like to be treated is common sense. And it's just, you know, there's no argument about it. But if in the film industry, we still have some way to go because people tend to fall back on stereotypes sometimes. And it comes from when the scripts are written. You know, I've been having interesting conversations with my peers, you know, they're talking about whether colorblind casting is a good idea or is not a good idea, you know, because it takes away the fact of race and you have to, you know, stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but it just has, it's not about casting, it's about the stories that have to be written and the stories that have to be financed.
Yeah, that's kind of, I think, the conversations that I seem to normally have too, that it's more about what's the story. And then why are certain stories not being given as much of an opportunity to be told? And then that becomes more of a question of, well, what's happening on a grassroots level with writers and filmmakers and producers to actually allow those voices to be heard? And, you know, I always use the example of, like, for example, I couldn't write a story about someone living in the Bronx or in Jersey because I've never lived that life. I've never really been immersed in that culture enough to be an authentic representation of that, as an example. And I think it needs to be more of an equal thing from the writing perspective, where these voices actually are given an opportunity, and then that filters down to everything else, onto casting and thereafter. But going back to the colorblind casting aspect, though, what's your view on the situation and sort of where we're at with roles that aren't sort of even gender or race specific? Say it just says business owner, and it's supposed to be a powerful, wealthy business owner, but that could be anything and anyone. It's quite generic, and it could be a big role or a small role. It doesn't matter. Do you still feel like what you're saying before, we fall back on that just by default means 1980s Gordon Gekko white guy who's mid-50s? Or
I think we have to be aware. I think we could cast anybody in that role. And as a casting director, we always push, or at least I always push, and I think a lot of my colleagues do, for the more diverse options. And that could be somebody who has, you know, physical differences, who is a woman, who's, you know, there are all kinds of different things that it's not just, you know, Mr. Joe Blogs. But then it's very complicated because then it's lazy writing. Because and that's what I said, the directors have to write. They shouldn't write a generic businessman. In the same way as I believe, you know, a lot, and I've studied script quite a lot, you know, film shouldn't be set anywhere. It should be set somewhere. Mm. You know, so it should be location specific. A character, it doesn't matter if it's your waiter will tell a story, or your businessman, or your businesswoman. Every role should be given a reason to be there, so then they're no longer bland. But if they are, because it's, you know, Doctor Number 4, or whatever it is, then go for something that's interesting. But then it's very difficult. One of the things that's very difficult in our industry is that there are so many more actors than there are roles. And there's always going to be like that.
What are you talking about, Lucy? Come on. We're working all the time, all of us.
I know, and just pretending, working and complaining that we don't work.
Instead. Exactly. That's just a ruse. That's just the reverse psychology that we do.
I paid so much money that you're all living in Hollywood mansions.
Oh, completely. All the time. We're on our pedestal looking down on people just all the time.
Except for the casting directors who are a little bit higher up and throwing, you know, little, you know, acid.
Exactly.
Torture you, because that's what we really like doing, is torturing actors.
Yep.
Now, I think it's very, you know, I've never met an actor who says that they have too much work. So I have never met an actor who said, hey, I've done four seasons of whatever it is. It's time for me to step aside so that somebody else can have work, because they're still trying to pay their bills. You know, there's very few actors who make enough money that they don't need to work. And the ones that do, they do it because they love it. You know, actors, you know, love their profession. So even when you've made your millions, you still want to work. You know, that's why you have actors, you know, they don't, you know, actors don't retire in the same way as other professions. You have, you know, these actors who are, you know, they're working when they're in their 90s.
You know, it's in the blood.
It's in the blood. So it's a very complicated thing. And it's very complicated. I can't say to an actor, I'm not pulling you to an audition because you have done three roles in the last 2 months. And now it's somebody else's turn to have a chance. They'd be like, yeah, but I'm better.
It's that kind of thing of, you have the creative artistic side, but then there's the business side as well. And like you say, it's complicated. There's levels to it, just like in any industry, I suppose. But for you, ultimately, the job is, I suppose, how can you help the director or filmmaker and producer bring the most authentic story to life based on what they've given you on that script, and help them build their world. And if they haven't devised it fully enough, then I guess you help nudge them in the direction of creating a world that's fully actualized.
Exactly. And I help to, I mean, I'm very much, I mean, I believe casting directors, we're very much at the service of the story that the director wants to be told. But sometimes on our jobs, you know, if we work for public television, then we have a bigger responsibility. So we can be more vocal in where we think the casting should go and where the storyline should go. And I know Pep Armengol, who I worked with here, and who I learned my craft from, you know, he's very vocal in the local TV about having new faces, having diversity, and, you know, but that's a discussion that when people are doing, you know, long-running TV shows, then casting becomes very important to that. Or if you work for a studio, you can talk to them about where the casting goes in their projects, or what kind of projects are being financed. There's all kinds of sort of different things that happen.
Absolutely. And so I'm curious now about how Spain and Barcelona kind of came into your life, and how you sort of built up your casting presence there. Was that always a conscious choice? Did it happen sort of just naturally, you fell into it? And then we can talk a bit about maybe the differences, if there are any.
I've been here for my whole adult life. I mean, I studied here. So I came here in the 80s to study. I didn't want to work in the film industry. Oh, has it gone? No. I came here to study as part of my bachelor's degree. I wanted to work in social policy. I did everything that was kind of right in terms of what I studied. I did, what's it called in Spanish and English? Humanities and social studies. That's what I have my bachelor's degree in. I wrote my thesis on unemployment and the, I wrote two theses during my bachelor's time. I wrote one on unemployment in the black market of youth employment in Spain. And my other thesis was on the NAACP and whether it was perspective or perception, you know, perception versus reality, which was because, and I'm talking about in the 80s, the NAACP was then seen as being very, very moderate. Mm. And their aims had never changed. And then I've been reading a lot about them at the moment because they're back in, well, not they're back in, they're very in the forefront of the news at the moment. In the States, I think, I can't believe that something I thought I studied as history and was put away to me is so relevant today. So my life was meant to go in a totally different direction. I graduated in 1990. There was a massive recession. I think that's why I feel particularly sorry, not sorry, I feel particularly empathetic with drama students who are graduating this year, with people who are finishing their university, you know, days. And I just wanted to say to any of those people, it's like, it's going to be okay. Like, you can go through these really terrible times. When I graduated, I thought there was massive unemployment in Ireland, which is where I'm from. And I'd studied in England, and I couldn't go back there. But I'd always thought that I would have a career in what I wanted to do, because that's why I moved to England. I moved to England when I was 16 to study. And everything that I wanted to do either didn't pay enough money, or there wasn't any employment. So I ended up going to Italy, and I lived there for a year, and I worked there. I wrote, and I worked for a helicopter company, Augusta Helicopters, writing for them. And then I met a lot of people in Barcelona, because I'd been on my year abroad here, and that's where I'd written my Tessina, my short thesis. And they said, hey, come back to Barcelona, because there's really cheap rent. And one of my friends was leaving his apartment. He said, I'll just tell them that you were my girlfriend and you can keep the apartment. And it's like a peppercorn rent. And I was like, cool, I can have a 120 square meter flat in the center of Barcelona that I can afford. So I came here with a friend, and we arrived. I arrived in Barcelona in 1990, the fall of, no, 91. I arrived here in 91 with, I had 100 euros. That was the entire amount of money that I'd had to come with me, which was...
What was that? In pesetas, what would that be, 100 euros?
It was... I think actually I had less. It was 600 mil or something. It was quite a lot. Kind of a lot more than it was, but I think I actually had less than 100 euros, now that I think about it. And then we were like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We lived in our flat. We didn't have any furniture. We didn't have a fridge. I used to hang out the vegetables and the milk on the washing line. So it was winter. It was freezing. And we started hustling, you know, finding out what to do. You know, I ran nightclubs, and I ran very, very successful nightclubs for many years here, which was nothing. I'd never been that kind of a person. I'd never worked in a bar. I worked in an old people's home during my university degree, because that was going to work towards what I wanted to do, which was social. And we ran extremely successful pool clubs that were known all over the world. I met everybody in the film industry because of that, because I could give out, I did the guest lists. I also could give out as much free alcohol as I wanted, because that was my thing. So I was a very popular person. We organized the film premiere parties, and I did that. And I worked as well with the Four Hills Fast, which is a theatre company. I managed their musicians. Then I went on tour with them for a while. I did a lot of different sort of underground. I had a magazine, I had a TV show, I had a radio show. I did all kinds of strange, not strange things, but just different things that I would never have imagined that I would have done. But that was how I lived my life, because what I wanted to do, which was very establishment, just didn't work out. And I've always been involved in theatre. I come from a theatre background in my family, so I've always gone to plays. I acted all through university, so it wasn't like an alien world. And then I was working in theatre, and I've always gone to the theatre. I've always gone to see quite avant-garde theatre. I spent my entire life going to the theatre, so I have a very strong understanding of this. Anyway, then I wanted a day job after a while. So I was offered a job at the Catalan Film Institute, where, in the interview they always said, did I speak French and had I worked in film? And I kind of just said, yeah. And neither of which was true. I'd done Irish intermediate certificate French. So I had a month to get my French up to being the bilingual production secretary, which I did. And then I learned that. And during that time, while I was there, I worked there for 7 months doing a big European TV show as the production secretary. I met the casting director, and he was like, and he needed somebody, and I found out what that job was, and he needed somebody who spoke English to help him on just one day. So I helped him for one day, and I went off, and then he was explaining about his job, and I thought, that's interesting. And then when I finished, he asked me, did I want to be his assistant? And I was his assistant for a while. I wasn't a very good assistant, I don't think. Then I went back to production. I've been head of production, and I've been a production coordinator and, like major stuff. But I kind of liked casting, and I'd help occasionally with stuff, or I'd started doing the contracts forecasting as part of my job as production coordinator. And then I kind of evolved into doing remote casting. And then Pep asked me to become his business partner because there was this very specific time in Spain where there was a lot of UK co-production. And so I was doing that. And that was kind of worked quite well. And then
here we are. Doing that.
And here I am, still doing it, still working.
How do you
I'm on COVID-19.
Well, that aside, how do you, I guess for anybody sort of watching or listening, what kind of differences, if any, are there between some of those UK or American projects that you've been asked to cast versus the local Spanish ones? I guess the process is the same, but are there any nuances or any differences in terms of any of it?
I think every project is different. Every project is a universe. There's lots of different nuances that are different. I mean, there's money that's different, but sometimes, I mean, I think it's who the decision making in local projects, the lower the budget, the more likely it is that the director has full autonomy to make the decision. And then when you go to a studio project, the studio executives will be making the decision. Like if I'm working for a TV like Netflix, there are people who have to approve the casting and they're not the people who are on the ground.
And are you normally then dovetailing with maybe other casting offices if it's a big sprawling thing? So yeah, you have to liaise with them as well and figure out what roles are yours.
And that also depends on the project. A lot of the times if I'm doing, you know, a Netflix project that's been originating in the United States, then there will be a lead casting director in the United States and they will definitely be running the casting and I'm working with them or for them. Sometimes I'm the lead casting director, you know, on a project and there will be other people who are I'm liaising with and they're working with me. And it really just depends, you know, and sometimes there'll be, you know, I'll be the European casting director and sometimes I'll be just the Spanish casting director or not just, but it kind of depends on the project. Sometimes I get the job title where I'm the European casting director. Sometimes I'm the Spanish casting director. And sometimes I'm the casting director and it's always slightly different and it's always about working out what works best because we're always at the service of the project. So it's entering into the universe and making sure that they are getting what the actors that they need and that are the best possible actors that work together for each project.
Yeah, because you're building that world, right? You can't have, if one is slightly out and the vibe's out, people are going to go, well, that can't be the son of those parents because that doesn't make sense. So obviously, in the UK, we've got Spotlight. In the States, you have Breakdown Services and Actors Access. But you work, obviously, a lot more closely with European actors from other countries, obviously Spain being one of them. I'm sure you do use Spotlight and Breakdown Services, but how do you go about sourcing actors from all these different countries? Do you have a set platform? Is it something like eTalenta? Or is it just word of mouth? What's that look like?
I use eTalenta. I think you use everything. I mean, if there was just one thing that you use, then anybody could do it. Like, you know, I go to, if it was just like, oh, put in, who are the good actors? You know, it's like, so I look at IMDb a lot. I watch a lot of films. I'm part of the European Film Academy. I see people here. I meet actors. You know, I've met actors in 100 different ways that I've cast. You know, I've met them because I've gone looking for them. I've met them. I mean, I've cast people who are, you know, I had to cast somebody who was a Quechua speaker. So I started off by, you know, looking for who were the Quechua teachers or, you know, in the local newspaper and then ringing them up and saying, hey, are there any actors who speak Quechua in your community? And, you know, the guy is called Amaru Paitapantes, had a really successful career. But I met him because I had to go to find who the people were that spoke Quechua. And that's a long time ago, or I've met actors sometimes because, you know, my friend has said, you have to meet this guy. I mean, there's an Indian actor who I've cast and who's now in Money Heist, which is a huge show in the world. But, you know, I met him because he was the neighbor of a friend who was like, there's this actor. He's moved here from India. He has to work in a factory. He's not at all happy with it. He looks like he might be talented. Can you have him in for casting? Like, sure. You know, and I've met people because I've seen people at drama school. You know, there's some well-known actors in Spain who I've seen them when they were kids and they were being extras on a show that I was working on. I was like, oh, that's a cute kid. And then they become big, you know, big time actors. And then I've seen all kinds of stuff.
How do you find that with the Spanish actors and that side of things? Because a lot of them obviously build great careers there locally, but obviously a lot of them look to make the jump, and more they can look at other people over the years that have done that. They can look at Antonio Banderas and Penelope Cruz and Paz Vega, and they can say, well, I can go away and maybe come back and then demand more. Do you feel that a lot of Spanish actors have that, I want to leave Spain for an English-speaking country, or do you think a lot of them say, no, I want to work locally?
I think it's individual. I think some actors dream, I think a lot of actors dream of having access to more roles. I think all actors want to work here. And Hollywood is still seen as the big industry. So a lot of people dream about having that because they perceive there to be more work there. But I think it's about having a choice. I think actors would like to be able to choose their roles. So whatever it does that allows them to do that, that's what they choose. And then obviously some Spanish actors do speak English and they want to do that and others don't. And it's slightly, and it's about playing interesting roles. And I think a lot more Spanish actors are seeing that they're great and interesting roles in Spain at the moment, particularly in TV. So they don't feel that they have to go so far. But it's a bit like what I was saying about the university class I was teaching. You know, when you ask people here what their favorite films are, they don't tend to say Spanish films. It's a little lack of Spanish self-love. Like I wrote about it at the beginning of the lockdown. In the Spanish newspaper, one of them, they asked 10 very well-known Spanish directors what films they would recommend for the lockdown. And only one of them mentioned in passing some Almodóvar films. And I was like, how can the Spanish leading directors only reference non-Spanish films? Mm. You know, and the same way as if you ask Spanish actors which directors they want to work with, they tend to talk about American directors. So there's a slight lack of love in the Spanish film industry, which doesn't happen in the French film industry, it doesn't happen in the Irish film industry, and it doesn't happen in the British film industry to the same extent. And I'm not sure about Italy or other countries.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know why. I remember, I mean, it feels like it's a definitely more booming industry now than going back 10 or 15 years. I mean, I'm just thinking back of, you know, when I used to watch Spanish TV and I was there and you'd see some telenovela or something on Antena 3 and you're like, well, it's there, but it doesn't feel like the quality that we're seeing now. And you know,
I don't think that's true necessarily. I don't know about 10 years ago. I mean, I'm watching Spanish.
I'm going back.
Yeah. But I particularly like Spanish kinky cinema, which is the movies. I like Lupe. I've watched that film, I think, 15 times, you know. And the Spanish film industry in the 20s was very strong, you know. But then when the dictatorship came, a lot of things, you know, there were studios in Spain, there was, you know, they could have had a, you know, could have, should have, would have. But, you know, the history of the last century meant that Hollywood developed as a strong power center, but it could have been Barcelona, you know. There was a great film studio here. It could have been France, you know, the Lumières. You know, there are a lot of things that happen externally about how films are financed.
Sure.
That stop things happening. And the same is like, you know, very important to know that, you know, women were amongst the first filmmakers. There's people like Alice Guy Blanche, who there's just been a documentary about. But because of the way that Hollywood developed, Hollywood is macho, but it doesn't mean that filmmaking. We have to be aware of that. That, you know, the history has kind of,
as it always does,
paints
the picture through the rearview mirror of a very particular way of looking at things. There's the story about Louis Leprince as well, the French filmmaker who invented the single lens camera, and he was going to go and patent it, and he never was seen again. He disappears, and he was the first one to theoretically capture the first moving image, and he was in potentially, arguably they say, a bit of a patent war with Edison, and his camera works and then it stops, he just disappears, never to be seen again. And then, as you say, history that follows looks totally different when people remember Edison and the Lumieres, not so much this French guy who lived in England who apparently, you know, recorded the first moving image, and how different could things have been. It was always interesting. Right, I'm seeing that there are people in the waiting room, so let's bring one in and get him to have a bit of a chat with you and save you from listening to me for a while.
Oh, that's fine.
Right. The magic of Zoom. Hello, Louisa. How are you?
Hello. I'm well.
Good.
How are you?
All good. You're on with Lucy Lennox. I'm going to shut up and let you guys have a good old chat.
Hi, Lucy. There's no need for the man to shut up, but it's nice to speak to you.
So where are you based, Lisa?
I'm based in London, pretty much zone 2, so not quite in the epicenter of it all, but out enough to get in when I need to. So I'm quite lucky. But it's also quite crowded, and at times like this, it's quite hard to keep that social distancing. But we're tracking along. And whereabouts are you based, Ben?
I'm in Barcelona.
Hey! I love it. Las Ramblas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. How is Spain dealing with everything at the moment?
I think it's kind of complicated. You know, we'll see. I mean, we're still on. I mean, we're coming out of it. We're in phase one at the moment in Barcelona, but it's been an extremely severe lockdown. So it's kind of working out what we can do. In Spain, the economy is very dependent on tourism, so they're trying to get that back. Otherwise, you know, the repercussions for this year are going to be very serious for people.
I saw they're going to open back up in, like, when did they say? Beginning of July, they were going to allow people to come in and not quarantine.
Exactly.
I get it, but okay.
People are saying that, you know, the sun will have killed the virus. The one thing I'm very aware of is that I know nothing about virology. And I think there are a lot of interests for people to say one thing or another. So it's just about listening. It's like what I said. I'm much more about listening than talking.
My mum's from Portugal. I choose sometimes to be selectively listening to what she tells me about things. Because she can be, let's say, off-piste with a couple of things. So yeah. I know the sun kills everything rhetoric. But yeah, I suppose in terms of where we are now, I just wouldn't mind asking a question in terms of the industry. With the industry as it was, we had Brexit and then this all happened. In terms of people who can perform, how important do you think it is now for like people who have like heritage that is European to get a European passport to be able to work in different countries? Or do you think visas will be applied in terms of passing and work opportunities?
Get a passport. Yeah.
Okay.
My advice is like, you know, I strongly believe that life is like a game of poker. So you have to play your cards. And if one of your cards is that you can have a passport that somebody else can't have, play the card. Doesn't mean it's fair. It doesn't mean that it's, I mean, I'm a strong believer that people should be able to travel and borders shouldn't exist. I'm a strong believer, you know, I was talking to, somebody who's more, you know, their political alignment is anarchist, that's Italian anarchy. But they were saying that the one thing that we should be promoting at the moment, which I actually believe, is that all people can travel, but goods can't travel. And that would change the world order tomorrow. So that if oil and tomatoes can't travel, but people can, the world will become a much, much better place.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Radical thing to think, well, if I want to eat avocado, then I have to go to where the avocado is. And it would resolve a lot of issues. But anyway, having said that, if you could get a Portuguese passport, get a Portuguese passport. Because film funding for Europe is dependent on state subsidies. And state subsidies come from the countries that belong to Europe. And Britain, because of unfortunate circumstances, in my opinion, will no longer be part of those subsidies. So I've cast projects recently that we don't cast British actors. So I cast, if I need an English-speaking actor, I can cast an Irish actor. I can cast somebody with a Spanish passport, I can cast somebody with a Portuguese passport. You know, there's a saying about casting is also about availability. So be available, you know.
We were talking just about whether it's important that, you know, people want to go to America to work. If you have a visa, yes, great. But if you don't, you can't.
Yeah, that's a process I'm currently looking into as well, the US visa. So that's really good advice. Thanks. I had a question, and I'm hoping it's one you've never been asked before. Just putting it out there. My chances are low, and if I'm playing poker here, I'm not sure I'm going to win this hand. But it's when you get a project to cast, do you have an idea of what you're looking for? And if you have the idea of what you're looking for, I would presume, are you ever... does that idea ever get changed by a particular actor in the room?
I have been asked this question before, so no thank you for that. Yes, it depends on the project. And I think the one message that I really want to give to all actors in this time, because I've been talking to so many, is that each project is different and each casting director is different. So in my case, it will depend on the project. Sometimes it'll be a project, I'll read it and I'll think, oh, it should be this person and this person and this person. Other times I'll read it and I won't have a clue. Like, there's nobody jumping off the page to me. And then I might do brainstorming with my associates at work, because I have assistants, or I might reread it, or I might look at the director's work to see where his universe or her universe is. And then I might leave it and then I might read it again until it comes to me. And sometimes I have to sleep on it to come.
Yeah.
Or it might be that the producer have very strong requirements about who they want for it. And then I start the casting process, and then suddenly somebody will walk in and I'll think, oh, they're right for it. And remember that when I find somebody who I think is right for it, I then have to get the director to believe that it was for the, or the producer, that it was his or her idea. Like, I can sometimes know who I think would be perfect for it. But if I say that in the first moment, then the director or the producer will react against that because they'll think that I haven't done my job. Like, I haven't started it up.
We have that in immersive theatre. It's a technique of making the audience think that what we're doing is actually their idea. And they're more likely to go with it and be engaged if they're like, wow, the story's going the way I've moved it. Whereas if you say, here's what we're going to do, they're a bit like, oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's the same in life.
Yeah.
Always. It's like one of the greatest gifts of communication that you can have is being able to convince people that it was their idea in the first place.
It's true.
And I find it very difficult. I mean, that's very counterintuitive. It's one of my biggest, being totally honest, one of my biggest problems as a casting director. And sometimes I have a friend who's a casting director in Spain, and she's always telling me that I should be more diplomatic and I should learn how to express my opinion in a softer way, because sometimes it's, you know, I'll be like this. Somebody will say that they want somebody who I know they can't have, and I'll say, oh, that's so ridiculous. And it doesn't work. In the same way, I will say, oh, this person's perfect for it. You know, and I've been sacked from projects because of that. Like, only one. But I, you know, because I was very clear, I thought somebody was right, and I knew that they would be a big star, and they are a big star today. But the director didn't like them. So we had a kind of slight about it. It's a much longer story, and it was. There's a saying in Ireland where everybody is entitled to a bad day, and I was in a bad day that day, so I had very little patience with the director and the whole production setup.
I feel in my life I've been very entitled then. Many a bad day. Question, just not about casting, like, you've obviously gone into casting because it's a passion. I think we all do things, hopefully, vocationally, according to our lives. But if you weren't doing casting, I'm really interested to know what you would have done.
Yeah, that's funny because I've already talked about that with Ashley.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'm not in casting as a passion. I think it's very interesting because somebody wrote to me, one of my university lecturers wrote to me quite recently, and they said, oh, we're so happy that you're doing what you always wanted to do. And I was like, I never wanted to do this. I love what I do, but I love everything that I do. You know, and I've worked in many different industries. I ran nightclubs. I worked in an old people's home. I paid for my university education by working in an old people's home. I loved working in an old people's home. I thought about that a lot. In fact, I mean, it was interesting because as I'd basically been unemployed for 2.5 months, I was looking to see what jobs there were around. And I'm qualified to work in an old people's home. I've done it for 3 years of my life. And obviously there was a huge demand in Spain because of the situation. And I was horrified that they were being paid less than what I was paid 30 years ago in Spain to work in old people's homes. And I worked in an old people's home when in England for the social services, because it was a really good job. I mean, I liked it because I like people and I like talking to people and I like talking to old people. And it was a very well paid job because I was on double time and overtime and I got holiday pay because I worked at the weekends because I could fit it in with my university studies. So if I wasn't working in what I'm doing and what I would have chosen to have done if the world hadn't been the way it has been, I would have worked in probably in social policy and housing, which is what I really wanted to work in. It's what I studied and what I believed that I was going to do. I was very committed to making the world a better place until I discovered that I wouldn't be able to afford to pay my rent with what making the world a better place was going to pay. And I'm talking, and I'm 52 this month. So I'm talking about what it was like in the 90s. You know, when I graduated in the 90s, there was an economic recession. I was just a Ashley, you know, I feel very sorry for all the drama students who are qualifying this year. I know it's tough. And for anybody who's finished their studies this year, whether it's their school studies or university studies, and that they thought that they were going to the next stage. That I was just, you know, my message to people at the moment is be patient. It will come. And I know that it's tough. The same way as it's tough for the people who've had to be locked down where they're trying to start something or they're trying, you know, to do something. I feel very privileged that the lockdown has come to me at this stage of my life where I kind of know what I'm going to do. I'm not trying to have kids and I don't have kids, so I don't have to educate them. I'm really glad that I didn't have to embrace the whole homeschooling experience.
There's a very different experience when you've got kids. Mine's a quieter experience without kids. But I also appreciate the amount of work that's put into homeschooling and working while you've got that.
And I think one of the things that I find, you know, in some of the cheaper press, they've been sort of saying, oh, we're all in the same boat. And I think what's really, really clear about this COVID-19 situation is that we are all in the same storm. But we've all got very, 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 very different boats.
100%.
Yeah, I've always said.
I was going to say, one of my friends is in India and he was in Goa when the lockdown hit. As soon as I heard his story, I'm like, we are, and as you say, a very different boat. He literally couldn't find food for 2 weeks. He was literally scavenging through the town to find what was there because Goa had shut down, tourist season had ended, and the locals who make their own food normally. We're still doing that, but he doesn't live there permanently. So he was having to just find what he could to sustain until they opened up the food sort of intake into the town again. And, you know, you hear that and then you go, wow, is queuing for 30 minutes at like a fancy air-conditioned supermarket really bad? But perspectives are different, you know, but yeah.
I've taken to using the phrase, we're not necessarily all on the same in the same boat, we're in the same cruise liner and we're all in different cabins.
Yeah. But I think even some of us are not even on that cruise liner.
Yeah, they're on outside the lifeboats.
Yeah. Some are on private yachts and some are on lifeboats.
Oh yeah.
100%.
Thick bag that they're just trying to stay afloat. So that's the way it goes.
So the people who try to stay afloat, you can just put a buoy out to them and make sure that they don't go under because I do believe we're all in it together. We're just at different levels of suffering.
Exactly. Don't be like Kate Winslet in Titanic, who pushed Leo off that table and made him die. Everybody can get on the door and float.
That was enough. There was enough space for three people. And I'm 4'9". There were three average-sized people spaces on that door. It was a massive door. She was selfish.
Well, it worked for the story, I guess. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for coming on, Louisa. It's been
chatting.
You brought your energy as always, which is great.
Thank you so much, guys. Enjoy the rest of your day. I'm sending love.
You too. Take care.
You too. Bye. Right. Let me see. There's a couple more people. So let me bring in the next one because
this finishes at 5, doesn't it, Ash?
Yes, what time are we on now?
9 minutes to 5.
Okay. Keep me, because I can't see my clock. So if we're getting that close, just tell me to move people along. Right, let's bring in Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Your audio's connecting slowly. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Andy.
I'm so excited. This is all working well.
Awesome. Well, you're on with Lucy. Over to you guys.
How are you, Lucy? You okay?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. You're there, your lovely sun-kissed skin from Spain. I basically want to ask your opinion on self-taping, and especially in the situation we are in, you know, the current situation with us possibly not being able to fly from country to country, because obviously with, you know, you being Spanish and English, do you feel that we have lost a certain connection with that one-to-one actor, casting director connection that you sometimes have with it, with an audition? You know, I feel as much as self-tapes are absolutely fantastic, and it does give you a chance to look back and say, oh my God, what am I doing with my hand? Let's do another one. And, you know, you can send the perfect tape. I don't feel like you get a chance to meet the casting director and get across your enthusiasm or your passion for the project. And I'm wondering whether in the future that's something that there's going to be more of, or whether people think about changing it more.
I don't know. And I totally, totally agree with you. Like, I don't feel so much to the casting director when I'm just administering self-tapes. And I've been saying it out, and I've been talking to the agents here, and like saying, you know, I've been doing self-tapes during the last 2.5 months. And I've been saying, tell, you know, the actors to call me, or the actor to call me.
Yeah.
Talk them through it. I want them to know the information that I have, if I can help them. I've done quite a lot of chatting, you know, WhatsApp video and stuff like that, with actors before they've done the self-tape.
Right.
Make sure that they have the connection, because that's what I do. I'm a casting director. I'm not a casting self-taped into a pie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of complicated, but I agree with you. I think it is, it's an interesting thing, because it means it's much more democratic. People are quite good at doing self-tapes now. They've all learned the tech side of it.
We have so much time to do it. We could, you know, we could do it over 2 days and get something that's completely perfect. But perfect isn't always necessarily right. And I feel like you need that chat with the casting director, because we both want the same thing at the end of the day. We both want this character to be right.
And then it just depends. It's like everything. There's some casting directors who will probably, you know, they prefer the more hands-off approach. I like being in the room with people, or I like to be in the room. Also, my associate does a lot of the directing in our office as well. So it's kind of interesting. And I just really don't know what's going to happen next, because I've also been a lot of self-tapes for the last couple of years anyway, because it means that people don't have to travel. So actors who
are of course.
So that's that. But I do think that one of the things I'm trying to do is to work on my communication skills, to take the time to actors before they do their self-tapes.
Yeah, because this is lovely. This is so, I think a lot has changed during this lockdown, because people have been forced to do Zooms and Skypes and FaceTimes and things. But it's so lovely to even if this could be part of the self-tape, where the self-tape goes, or like you say, before the self-tape is even there, you get a chance to say, right, okay, can we discuss? And then, you know, send the audition tape over.
I think that's important. It's about learning how to give the communication skills that people
want. Yeah, great.
Awesome.
That's all. I mean, unless you want me to stay longer and I can chat all day.
No, because Lucy, a big press for time.
I've been stuck at home with a 1-year-old for 10 weeks. I am desperate to talk to like someone normal.
Well done.
Thank you. Bye, Rachel. Lovely to meet you too. Take care. Thanks, Ashley. Bye.
Right, Lucy, one last person, but I'll tell her to be quick. We have 5 minutes, I think.
We have 5 minutes.
And she did say she might have her little one with her, so brace yourself. She might have her little one running around. Hello, Flaviana. How are you? Not to put a Jack Bauer style timer on you, but Lucy's got about 5 minutes, so
go. Okay.
Run over if you need to. How are you?
No, I try to be brief. Hi, Lucy. Hi, Ash. Thank you so much for having me. My question is in regards to other fellow actors that find themselves in a situation like I am. I've been in the business for a while, but I haven't built a strong CV for whatever reason. And, you know, let's not get into the negatives. But I'm not from a big agency. Again, not going to go down that route because my agent is amazing and I love her, you know, but I'm looking for opportunities for smaller roles and one-liners, you know, to build a CV that way. So I'm always hoping for opportunities going that way. So how are you and the people that you work with more likely or less likely to bring in a wild card you haven't met before to an audition, considering all the time restraints for the, you know, casting in general, but in particular, so many roles for one single project?
It just depends on the project, you know, and that's the thing. It's like, depends on the project. I mean, I would normally bring in somebody for a one-liner who's somebody who I'd have met, but it might have been met them very briefly. It might be like, I've just met you now.
Yeah.
And you said, oh, she, and, you know, I would say, oh, where are you based, Fabiana?
I'm actually near Cambridge in the UK, but I'm Brazilian. So,
like, if I'm suddenly looking for a Brazilian girl in England, yeah, and I go, oh, there's Fabiana, who I met.
Yeah.
You know, and then I would go for that. Or, oh, who was that, you know, guy who I met on that self-tech course who speaks Spanish?
Oh, okay.
So then, oh, that's Ashley. Oh, I'll bring him in, you know, or, oh, he might be available. So we're always looking for people, but it does mean we're never looking for work for actors. We're always looking for the right person for the role. And I think that's very frustrating for actors sometimes because they think, oh, I've met her. She loves me. She thinks I'm amazing. Why hasn't she got me a role?
You know, we understand.
Like, who are actors who are working for me today? And they're like, that's why we're here. We're helping you because you're going to get us a role. Is that right, Stephanie? She's the only reason she's here in lockdown helping me do something. But I'm just telling her that it's not going to, if the role happens, it will happen. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. So it's just one of those things. And it's just about meeting as many people as possible, getting involved as many projects as possible, doing as networking, doing something like today.
Yeah.
Just keep going and just believing. It's an Irish expression. That's what's for you won't pass you.
Oh, yeah. We have something similar in Brazil. Yes. But on the end of that one is, what would turn you on or off giving you an opportunity to a wild card you haven't met before?
Would just be if I needed them to, you know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, like in your case, you're unique. If I needed a Brazilian actress in England, I would give you an opportunity because you speak Brazilian and most people in England don't speak Brazilian.
Yes.
You know, I might be, it's not, you know, we're always trying to find new talents. You know,
yeah.
I'm always casting people in their first roles, but it would have to be, you know, that the project desire wants that and that I could feel that they were trustworthy.
Trustworthy.
And that might be a trained actor, but somebody's going to turn up and it's not going to suddenly go nuts on set.
Yes, make you look bad in front of the entire production team. Yeah, thank you so much, Lucy.
Fabiana.
Awesome. Thanks, Ash.
No worries. Thanks, Fabiana.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Wonderful. All right, Lucy. I think we maybe just about made it with a little bit of time to spare. So thank you so much for doing this.
Really welcome. I hope I answered the questions in the way that works for you.
There's no right way or wrong way, just your way. So it's always good to chat and connect. I appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day, and hopefully the casting process kind of goes back up to speed for you and you find a way.
You're from Barcelona.
Whenever we're allowed to travel again, whenever that might be.
Okay. All right. When you're, thank you for having me on your show.
My pleasure. Take care. Un abrazo. Bye. Bye.
Ciao.